You spoke here in Eureka Springs. Why don't you bring our audience up to date about the subject? What you cover?
Mm-hmm. Well, this time I was talking about what I call Project Tatra, which is a project started in 1970. Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who was the Air Force UFO Project scientific consultant, and I initiated this project in 1970 to try to locate and reach a large and very old structure, which is located 2 miles inside a cavern about 2,700 feet below the mountaintop in eastern Slovakia near the Ukrainian border.
Now, tell us a little bit about this. How'd you find out about it to begin with?
In 1970, I was contacted by a friend who was a UFO and a researcher, and living next door to him was a man and his wife from Bohemia, which was in the northern Czech Republic. And they had moved to the United States in 1951. And he said, this man is incredibly intelligent, highly educated, and has an incredible story. So we made the arrangements to meet with him. The gentleman's name was Antonin T. Hurok, and at the time was 72 years old. And I went out and spent 2 days with him at his home. And during World War II, of course, when the Nazis took over Czechoslovakia and Poland, they arrested any business people and put them in concentration camps, and they took all of their worldly possessions. And Tony and his wife were very, very wealthy property owners and business people in that area. And so the Nazis took even her wedding rings from her fingers and placed Tony in a concentration camp called Thaimwald. And he was there from 1939 to 1941. He escaped. He fled to Slovakia and joined the insurgents or the partisan fighters in the Slovakian underground army against the Germans. And he quickly became a captain. And in October of 1944, in one of the last battles during the war, he was in far eastern, northeastern Slovakia in a terrific firefight, and all of the 184 men in his battalion were killed except for Tony and two others. And they were seriously wounded and were unconscious. And when he awoke hours later, a Slovakian sheep herder who owned quite a vast property around the area there was dressing their wounds and building a stretcher to pull the most seriously injured soldier to a tiny cavern entrance, which took 4 hours to reach. There was very heavy snow, very bad weather. And the interesting thing was that when they reached this little crevice, the opening, there were stones piled up in it, concealing the entrance. And when they entered the cave, it opened into a fairly large, roomy entrance room or grotto. And the sheep man became very ceremonious. He blessed himself, the soldiers, the cavern, and especially the area at the back of this entrance room where the cave went on. And this made Tony a bit curious, because Tony Hurok had 4 degrees in engineering, mining engineering, linguistics. He could speak fluidly 7 languages and could teach, and also had a degree in business management, had ran many mines. He was very familiar with the underground. And so when this Slavic sheepman became so religiously involved with the cave, he's thinking, you know, why? And so as the sheepman, Slavic, was about to leave them in the cave to return to his home, he asked Tony, please, not to go further into the cave, because he had been taken there years earlier by his father and his father's father, and that there were many dangerous pets, poisonous air, and the place was haunted. And please not to go into his cave. And as soon as Slavic was out of there, Tony, being a mining engineer,
say this was an invitation for him to go look at.
Yes, yeah. Any self-respecting mining engineer would want to go in there. And but they had not eaten for 4 days, so they were thinking bat sounded really good. And so Tony foraged on back with torches.
So he actually had bat fillet or something.
Yes. And they liked to call, when they did catch bats, they did like to call them pigeons. And they pretended that it was good, really good food. And so at any rate, after an hour and a half of walking and some crawling through squeezeways, he found himself walking down a long level corridor some 2 miles into the cave. And he went through a very low area that he had to squeeze through. And the cavern then opened up into a large room. At the far end of the room, there was visible this large black expanse of some shiny black material. And surrounding this material were flowstones formations, stalactites, stalagmites, attached to this object, to this structure. And the dark wall area extended upward about 27 feet, disappeared into the cave room ceiling, and about 15 feet wide into the cavern formations. And as he's looking at this thing, as a geologist, a miner, my engineer, he could not fathom what material this was constructed of, because it was seamless. No rivets, no blocks, no lines, no anything. And it was like looking into a sort of bottomless black mirror. Very smooth, very glassy, very reflective material. And there was a crack that was narrower at the top, widened somewhat at the base, or the floor of the cave room, a crack in this outer wall. And in taking his clothes off, he was able to make his way through the crack, through the outer wall itself. Which
was, so it was that tight?
Yes, it was very tight. It was very tight. And he determined as he went through the wall that the wall was 7 feet thick, which is a pretty substantial wall. As he was going through the crack, it was sloping downward at about a 60-degree angle, and he found himself then sliding down the floor until he slammed into the far wall inside the object. And as he gathered up his torches, he could see he was inside a really huge shaft that extended upward for some unknown distance. He couldn't see the top of it. And the shaft was shaped like a crescent moon. And as he said, with mathematically curved walls, concave, convex, front and back, and he was standing on a slope of limestone deposit. On each day, he would go back to this thing. Curiosity, of course, really piqued, and would measure it. He tried to obtain samples of the wall material by hitting it with his pick, which would simply bounce off and wouldn't even leave a mark on this material. And
at this time, that had to be phenomenal. I mean, there was no material like that around, I don't think.
No, absolutely not. The only thing he could liken it to was a tremendously high quality, extremely highly polished steel. And yet it didn't have really a steely appearance. And it was just something he had not seen before. And so at any rate, on subsequent trips inside the artifact, he discovered that the limestone floor had some weak points over in the horns of the crescent shape of the artifact. And this thing was 85 feet long and about 30 feet in width between the walls inside. And so he began working on the limestone deposit with his pickaxe. And he finally, over a period of 3 days, managed to break through 60 inches of limestone deposit. And under this 60-inch of deposit, he saw a pocket of what looked like enamel. And as he excavated that area, he found that it was the skull of a large animal. And so he took a canine and two molars. And later, the animal was identified at the museum in Uzhhorod, Ukraine, to be a prehistoric cave bear.
Well, let's get back to that in just a moment. We've got to take a commercial break. This is Jerry Pippin, and you're listening to the UFO Files. Okay, so this turned out to be, 11 minutes again. We're in the cave. He has been using the pickaxe, comes across the skull, he takes out part of it, and turns out to be prehistoric.
Yes, identified at the largest museum in the Ukraine after the war as a prehistoric cave bear. And the interesting thing is that the prehistoric cave bear, the last one, was killed 11,000 years ago. And this type of bear existed back 1.8 million years. So then the question is, how did it get inside the artifact, which was plenty large to house the bear? But when a man can barely wriggle through this tiny crack, how would a 20-foot-long bear that weighs several tons do this? Well, he couldn't have. And as a matter of fact, even just the head of the bear would not have gone through this crack.
So it appears that maybe this 7-foot matter or wall of something must have come afterwards.
Well,
or am I wrong?
You know,
what do we know?
Well, we don't know. I guess would be the safest answer. We just don't, until we can really examine everything about this artifact. Did not, and I questioned Tony back in 1970 about did he find any surface debris, any surface material, which would have been preserved under these conditions, under the limestone, if the bear had fallen in, for example, an opening above the artifact and down into it that way. He would have carried a lot of surface material with him. This is a huge animal. And there was no indication of any surface material around this bear at all. And so the interesting thing is, we know the bear was between 11,000 years and 1.8 million years in age. That's quite a span, but... And it was found beneath what normally would be about a 6,000-year deposit of limestone. So we're talking about considerable age here, and that's only for the bear. And obviously the artifact existed before the bear, and of even greater interest, as he cleared the skeletal remains around, he found that the bear was lying on a wavy constructed grill work that extended downward beneath his feet to a much greater depth. And he was sure he could feel some warmth coming through, warmer air, this grill work. So he placed his ear, which is very sensitive to temperature, against the grill. And not only could he feel heat coming up through it, but at some distance below his feet through the grill, he could hear what appeared to be the sound of an enormous turbine engine or something like that. Now, you have to remember, this was a mining engineer with years and years of subterranean experience. I've explored caves since I was 14, which is a couple hundred years. And
well, not quite.
Close, anyway. But I probably actually saw a prehistoric cave bear, too, if I could remember. But at any rate, he would have easily determined the sounds of dripping water, things that you might naturally find in a cave.
He actually heard a turbine engine, he thinks. What it was.
That was the only thing he could relate to, this pulsing sound. So lo and behold, then, 30 years later, over 30 years, on my second trip to the site, in looking for the cave, as I was getting closer to the actual site, there was an area on the mountain where anything that was powered, battery powered, would just stop operating. And this area, you could actually measure it. It was about roughly circular and about 25 feet wide.
Wow, incredible. That had to get your attention.
Yes. And of course, this was on the surface. And at that point in time, I had no idea where the entrance was. I knew generally it had to be somewhere in that area. And so at any rate, the next trip up onto the mountain, I took an electromagnetic field meter and some other instruments. And I placed those instruments and three compasses on the ground, stood back with the video camera, and taped them as in 2 second intervals, everything would swing and peak out. The compasses would all swing, come back. The EM meter would peak out, come back. And this was on precisely 2 second intervals. So there was an electromagnetic signal or pulse coming from the mountain at this point. Well, then several days later, when I finally located the entrance, one of the first things I did was to survey the cave to get the exact layout of it, and it was headed back in the direction of this pulsing. So my theory is, of course, that the pulsing is coming from the artifact, from far below.
Did you ever actually find the entrance?
Yes. Actually, I almost fell into it, and it still had some of the stones concealing the opening. And but I had sketches from Hurok's diary, fortunately. And as I went into this thing, I watched for any indication of Hurok and the two men that they might have left. And there was a calendar that they had burned onto the wall. Carbide lights are great for that. And because a carbide light will shoot an extended flame about 3 inches long. And the Army issue carbide light for the Slavic military was issued one lamp per man. So if they were fighting at night, they would have some means of finding the way. And so on the in the entrance room, they had the carbide light, and they had burned, and I have to admit I've done this in caves to mark my way out, had burned.
Most people don't think about that, but it's pretty important once you get in there to figure out how to get out.
Precisely, especially if you're in a maze sort of cave where there are a lot of side passages. It becomes very complicated. And when you turn around, you're going the opposite direction. Everything looks different. And so at any rate, they had burned 7 days onto this calendar, and which was the period they were in the cave. and a 23 at the beginning, and they went into the cave on October 23rd, and October 28th, they left, and there's a 28 at the end of the calendar. It has his initials, H.A., and down the wall, the initials of one of the soldiers, J.F., Eric, and Martin, who was the most seriously wounded, they had placed in a small alcove in the cave, and they placed all this written in great detail in his diary. He kept this magnificent diary. And in the diary, he describes heating stones, placing them around Martin's body so he wouldn't get too cold and go into shock. And on the seventh day, Martin died in his alcove. And so I found the alcove, and I found the stones still in place, a perfect outline of a human body, and bandage, about 20 feet of bandage. And just below and at the opening to the alcove, the letter M for Martin, and an arrow pointing up into the alcove, which was their sort of little memorial to him. So everything was there, and the burned calendar and the scratched initials had just enough limestone deposit to indicate that they had been there for a goodly number of years. So it was not some recent thing that was done. And so I'm absolutely sure this is the cave. And the problem is that part of the entrance room floor that they'd lived in has collapsed. And there is some collapse, not blocking totally, but making very dangerous passage on back to the artifact. And the reason is the mountain's covered with bomb craters. And after Tony and the and Eric left the cave, there was a lot of aerial bombing by the Germans and Russians on that mountain. The vibrating, of course, generated a lot of instability in the cave. So when I return later this year, I'm taking a mining engineer from Poland who will be able to do the shoring up to make it safe. And I don't mind hanging upside down 40 feet down into a debris cone one time, but I don't want to do that two times and have some of this debris come down on top of me, because it's, you're not going to get to the artifact if you're dead.
Right. You got a good point there. So actually, you haven't made it back that far yet.
Not to the artifact. But I am now assured that I have the location. And the Russians are also looking for the artifact. They initiated a huge project in 1981. The problem for the Russians is they do not have the map of the cave, and they do not have the sketches of the cave location. And Tony Hurok died in 1976, and with him went everything except the copies that I have. And
so you are actually in sole possession of only, for lack of a better term, a roadmap to where this might be.
Yes, absolutely. And of great importance is the cave map sketch. Because on his last trip out, fearing that treasure hunters would find the cave and get back to this, he blocked three of the crawlways. So if you found the cave, you would not find the artifact in this maze without the map.
It sounds very, very, the thing that jumps out about me about the story is that he took a lot of trouble to mark the thing and to protect what he had found. We'll be right back to, and get the further details on this right after these words.
Tell me when we're getting close to where you got to go do your broadcast.
Mm-hmm. What time is it?
Yeah, I don't know.
I'll have to have glasses to be able to see this.
No. Probably the chair is interesting enough.
Okay, I've got
two more six. I've got a 9-minute segment for sure we need to do.
9 minutes, ma'am?
Yeah.
There was something extraordinary about that. Are you able to read something in his mind?
Well, since a lot of people would like to have the information you have, you don't seem to have any fear about telling people you have it.
No, I have, I think, fairly well dealt with the Russians. I, after my first trip over, I found on my computer an email message from a Russian scientist in Moscow, which began with the sentence, like you, we too are looking for the artifact. And not exactly what I wanted to find on the computer. And he suggested that we work together. And, of course, because I have the data that they require.
Yeah, you have the map.
Yes, exactly right. And so I pondered this for a week and because I wanted to make a careful reply. And so I answered that I thought, well, I have no problem with helping you. And if I was looking for the entrance, this is where I would go. And I gave them the bearings. And unfortunately for them, it was as far from the artifact, the actual cave, as I could send them. And one of the very roughest sections of the Carpathian Mountains. So they're probably Russians strewn all over these mountains now. It's rough country.
Now, when he found the bear, the prehistoric bear, and he heard the noise, this was like the fifth or sixth day, I take it.
Yes, yeah, it was very near the end of the stay, because it took him, 3 days of very hard work to break through the limestone material. And but this is also significant because it helps us to get some feel for the age of this structure. And I talked with the leading geologist in the Czech Republic without mentioning the artifact, but I simply discussed with him. And by the way, one thing that's helped me a great deal is that Dr. Hynek was from Bohemia, which is in the northern Czech, was in the northern Czech Republic, and so they are all aware of Alan Hynek, and they were willing to help any way they could, and so the leading Czech geologist, my questions to him were the generation of the mountains where this artifact is located. Entombed. And, I said, suppose you had something that existed on the surface prior to the upheaving of the mountains. At what point would this thing have been caught up in the upheaving of the mountains and taken with them? And he said, well, that would have been the upheaving was generated 67 million years ago. And frankly, the only way I can see that this could be inside this mountain is it predated the mountains. And it was caught up in them. And then, of course, the cave formed naturally in the millions of years afterward.
So in other words, other than a subterranean village or operation or building or whatever this is, you figure it was on the surface at one time?
Yes, I think it was. I think originally it was constructed on the surface, and there are some indicators that whatever this is below, that this was a housing area for whoever built this thing.
Well, the first thing that jumps out at me, when you talk about how old this thing might have been and it was on the surface, what it could be powering the thing to make the noise this many years later?
Mm-hmm. Well, and yes, that's obviously there's some technology there because today we're not in a position to build something that will run for 67 million years. And however, there are some relatively simple processes that could have come into play. And that is, for example, many, many years ago in the early 20s, there was developed a crystal radio. And this thing requires no electricity, no batteries.
I'm very familiar with that. That's how they used to listen to the first radio stations. KDK in Pittsburgh was picked up all over the world, or at least the United States, because on crystal sets. And at first I thought, well, that's just the way to pick it up. But it's actually very little power.
Yes, absolutely. And I have, since this occurred to me, the artifact is sitting in a mountain of iron pyrite. And iron pyrite is the finest material, mineral, to generate radio signals, to pick up radio signals. And so, in effect, could you be looking at the largest crystal radio on the planet, in effect? And it would, 100 million years from now, it would still be operating perfectly well because it has no power consumption. And so what I've done a good bit of research into long wave reception, and actually we're using long wave frequencies for subterranean communication in mines, the military, submarines operate on the long wave. And, you know, of course, if you take, say, a pair of walkie-talkies into a cave, as soon as you go around one bend, you've lost the signal. Not so with long waves. As a matter of fact, long waves use rock and the ground to transmit themselves. And it's no problem to pick up a long wave signal 8,000 miles away underground. And so I've been working rather frantically on coils that would reduce the frequency of a crystal radio down to a point where you can pick up the long wave signals, and it works quite well.
So you could actually pick up a long wave?
Absolutely, yeah. I have radios that will pick up, Moscow, Germany, with no power whatsoever.
And through the ground, the ground signal.
Well, those signals through the air.
Okay.
But using the underground antenna system with no aerial, in other words, you can pick up, I've listened many, many times to an American military project at the North Pole, and it'll absolutely blow the windows out of the room with using nothing but a tiny little iron pyrite crystal.
So it's that loud?
Yes, yes.
Well, we have a couple of minutes left here. We're going to keep checking with you to see how this story goes. You planning to go back anytime soon?
In September, yes. And this time there will be a small team, and it's made up of myself and three Polish scientists and one Slovakian scientist, and we fully expect to get to the artifact.
And do you have any idea what the 7-foot, for lack of a better term, wall is? Did he have an idea?
No. As a matter of fact, in his diary, he sat there writing the diary by one of his torches inside the artifact on the last time in. And he says, basically, I am an academically trained person of some intelligence, and I cannot fathom the purpose of this structure, or who could have built it, or when it could have been built. And so until we get to it and can study it, and particularly the area below the visible artifact, the known artifact, it's pure conjecture.
Well, we have about a minute left, and it's always dangerous to close a show with a leading question like this, but you've been in caves all your life and been involved in this type of research. What about subterranean bases? You know much about those?
Well, you know, it's something that I've kind of laughed about for a long time. However, I'm starting to see some things that makes me a little more than just curious. As a matter of fact, there is a good possibility that there are at least two more of these artifacts, and they're both in the United States, and very, very similar structures. So that's on the to-do list.
Curiosity, how'd you hear about those possibilities?
Well, actually, I found out about those through Michael Crimmo, who did a magnificent 952-page book called Forbidden Archaeology. And well-documented research, the guy is solid as a rock, and he alerted me to these two possibilities.
Are they in the same part of the United States, or do you know?
No. One is in Oklahoma, one is in Ohio.
One's in my home state, probably down by the Arbuckle Mountains someplace, in the southern part of the state.
Absolutely right.
Well, see, I'm not an expert, but I took geology at San Francisco State.
All right, all right. Well, you're right on the money, so. But at any rate, I'm going to look into those, and especially using the long-wave radio to try to see if, indeed, there is any pulsing there.
Well, we're going to stay in touch with you, and when you get to Oklahoma to check that one out, let me know. I'll go with you.
I certainly will.
You'll have to squeeze through the rock first.
Okay.
I'll just stand back with the microphone and the tape recorder. Okay?
Well, for sure, if I can get through it, you're all right.
I've enjoyed it very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.